Mingling with matriarchs, storytelling, learning, laughing with Native women on unceded Musqueam territory. Warning, the following content contains powerful words by strong Native women that could literally knock your mocks off. Viewer discretion is advised.
Celia Joseph Queen Sna Tanatin Slat Gohomish Sna Namoth Ohomeo Alowin Iaxduin Isqualowin Eotin Stiquetal Ihaichka Musqueam OCM. My name is Celia Joseph. I'm from the Squamish and Nanaimo Nations. Thank you so much for joining us for Mingling with Matriarchs, a podcast series that is being conducted through the First Nation Studies program here at UBC in partnership with CITR Radio 101.9 FM. I want to thank the Musqueam Nation, whose beautiful unceded ancestral and traditional territory we're situated on at UBC, and thank you for their ongoing generosity for letting us be here. Welcome to Mingling with Matriarchs, a podcast series that exclusively interviews different Indigenous women on the UBC campus and talks about the work that they're doing and how they've made spaces within the university to tell their own stories. The most common rhetoric surrounding Native women includes narratives of violence, victimhood, promiscuity, and death. Where do these narratives come from? Why Native women? And why are these depictions so far from what we know about the women that we love in our communities? Anishinaabe and Mexican-American scholar and activist Dori Nason talks to us about the work that she's done in Indigenous literature and Indigenous feminisms. Dori has a PhD in Indigenous women's literature from UC Berkeley. Dori has been a really important instructor for me and many others because of the work that she does and her relationship with her class and the topics that we cover and how intrinsically related they are to our own experiences. It was my total pleasure to interview her. And so really, this was just an excuse for me to get the behind the scenes on all of this amazing work she does. So I really wanted to think about how she came to be able to teach Indigenous literature courses and feminisms courses. What was the process of getting there? And so we started at the very beginning, we started with her love of literature, and I asked her where that came from.
I was the child, and this is not a lie, that would get in trouble because I read too much. And so my parents would force me to put down the book and go out and play, which annoyed me to no end. And then just really fell in love with books. And so, of course, I wanted to go into the teaching of literature or just be in a program where I could keep doing that for my living. My dad is Anishinaabe from northern Minnesota, and my mother was a Mexican farm worker who grew up all over the states doing that work. And so I was much more interested in Chicano literature and Native literature. And so I had dreams of maybe being a creative writer, but then realized that's just not my skill set, but that I was good about thinking about what the stories had to say. And so I think I told my mom at 5 that I wanted to be a professor.
What were the stories that interested you the most?
I was mostly interested really in women's stories for a general category as a young girl. And so anything that was told from the perspective of some kind of oppressed woman really got me interested in and helped me think through like what was their journey to get out of whatever it is that they were working towards.
When did you start to engage in more of the work that you were wanting to do in school?
You know, Native studies and Native literature studies really is, you know, a very recent discipline. And so people in my generation are a lot of us are self-taught. But my first Native literature course was at the University of Nebraska way back. I'm not going to say the year. Just say it was before.
A few years ago.
I wore lots of flannel and stuff at that time. I took a course. Her first name was Kelly, a Lakota scholar at the University of Nebraska. And she was amazing. She totally scared me. I was that student that took my first Native studies course for one, and it was on Native literature, and felt that I knew that that was my interest and where I came from. I think this is a common experience for Native students in a university, but never had the chance to really explore that. And so all that like identity stuff and feeling really shy and that I didn't know enough and that I should know these things and why don't I know these things. It was totally intimidating because I was living in Nebraska and she was a Lakota scholar and I felt distant from my community and that my experience wasn't hers. And so I was just really shy about who I was, although she totally picked me out right away and and you know, demanded I be present and talk. Mm-hmm. And so I was also just a shy student, kind of intimidated by that. She was insistent that students let go of their need to control the story and to listen carefully as they're reading through. I was the only Native student in that course. Unfortunately, I'll admit this, I didn't pass that course.
Uh-oh.
I actually failed my Native literature course, and now I teach Native lit because I got so overwhelmed by the stuff that we were reading, and I just didn't finish. But I also tell that story because I'm with my students who are struggling. I'm like, look, I failed my Native lit course. You can do this. You can come back. And everyone has these moments in university, I think.
Well, it also speaks to the real visceral relationship between being an Indigenous student and learning about your experiences and your stories.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can relate to that. And I know friends that have just had to step away.
Yeah. Yeah. I witness it every year. So I know what to expect, and I know how to helpfully help students through that. And it's also just, you just know that that's going to happen. You're going to have lots of people in your office and wanting to talk through things and helping them through that initial stage. It happens.
Burst into tears.
It happens all the time. So, and it happened to me too.
At what point were you then further introduced to Indigenous literature and able to incorporate it into the work that you were doing? And how was that transition for you?
I had the opportunity to create my own courses around Native and Chicano lit. But again, I still had to create my own courses. And when that happened, it was really motivating. It was really freeing. It was scary at the same time because I didn't have peers to help me through that. Being able to think about how can I take the next step in my education to look at the questions that I was interested in literature. And that was, at that time, feminist literature, but there wasn't a lot of discourse around Native feminism in the States then.
So when did that language emerge, and what was the context that it emerged in?
Well, when I first started my project on knowing that I wanted to think about and articulate what a Native feminist literary critique might look like, of course, my first step was to think about what is the state of Native feminism in the States. In the late 1990s, there was a bit of a reorienting of Indigenous women's activism in the States. So a couple articles that came out from Indigenous women activists tried to make a distinction between mainstream feminism and what Indigenous women were doing. And so they kind of wrote these pieces that refuted the term feminism as being something that was Western and white. But at the same time, I knew there were Native feminists, and how did they articulate what they were doing? There was early scholars in the 1980s who were coming out of the 70s and are trying to articulate what would American Indian women's feminism look like, or what is Native feminism? And so when I started doing my research, I was a little bit scared because I was like, oh no, everyone's saying that this is not important, this is not who we are, and it's anti-Native, it's not Native. But I also didn't want to let go of that identity for myself, and became involved with a group of scholars at the University of California and professors from all over. So we met at a conference in Ohio, and we just had these conversations really outside the conference in the place that we were staying, and started to articulate what is important. Again, doing that same thing. What is important? How would we define it? Do we want to use the term? And if we do, why? Mm-hmm. And I think it was Cheryl Suzak that kind of stepped up when we were debating whether or not this was a useful term to Native women. She was like, you know, we all kind of talk about this term as if it's static and only belongs to one group of people.
Right.
And we're forgetting that we are women who grew up reading Audre Lorde and Patricia Hill Collins, and Gloria Anzaldúa, all these wonderful women of color feminists who have done the same thinking. And how arrogant are we to say that it's a term that can't be indigenized, and that women of color who have done that are being naive or have some kind of false consciousness? And it's also disingenuous because we use their work all the time, whether or not we credit it. So for her to get up and say that, I guess kind of ethically challenge us a little bit about our own, I think it was arrogance, that, you know, let's stop worrying about whether or not this term is what we want, and let's actually start doing the work in an academic sense. Let's start making this an important conversation, because in Native studies, you know, to a lot of people, it's still kind of dominated by perspective that doesn't take into account gender, feminism. So we wanted to change that. And so we started to do the work. We started to attend conferences and call ourselves Native feminists and try to produce scholarship quickly that could bring this to the table. When you do say, this is my perspective, then people know what it is that you're going to bring to the conversation. Mm-hmm. They know that you're going to be focusing on the ways that colonization and gender are linked, and that you're not going to let scholarship ignore those questions. Mm-hmm. You're not going to let the conversation that you're in ignore those questions. And that for most of us, the work that we're doing is focused on activism that's based on life or death. So that Indigenous women are targeted for elimination, and not just culturally, but physically. So this work feels like it's necessary, but it's also, it can't be ignored anymore, and it can't be mm-hmm. this theoretical conversation about a term.
A part of how you make the conversation about feminism more accessible is about thinking of love. Can you tell me what that means, and also about your article, We Hold Our Hands Up?
That piece that I wrote that talked about Indigenous women's love and resistance, it came out of a talk that I gave for a teach-in at the Longhouse here at UBC for the Idle No More movement. And so I think on the panel with me, there was a number of perspectives that we were going to give to a mainstream audience here at UBC and in Vancouver about what do you need to know about what's going on right now in the media? Why is this movement happening? Why is it inciting so much buy-in by Indigenous people? Like, what, you know, what is it that's happening around you, and how can you understand? The people who were important at first in motivating the Idle No More movement were women. Mm-hmm. Whether it was the four founders or the kind of activism that was represented by Teresa Spence's FAST. I was thinking about, this is what I think about this movement that I see as important to contextualize. And this is the same thing that I have in my argument about Indigenous feminism, is that it's not a post-70s movement. We might give it a term that's contemporary to the work that we do and the critiques that we're making, but Indigenous women have always been on the forefront of articulating a standpoint on Indigenous women's rights and place, not only in mainstream context, but in their own communities. And they have struggled to maintain or reinstate status for themselves, not like Indian Act status, but their place, rights and responsibilities in their community. So I wanted to make that connection for people. And for me, it has been such a struggle and such a challenge that I could focus on the struggle and challenge only and that kind of way of thinking about resistance, but I wanted to talk about their motivation, and mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about it in a way that kind of, I think, encapsulates what is at the core of an Indigenous feminist ethic, is this love for your community, love for future generations, love for your land. And that's what makes that movement unbreakable and mm-hmm. continuous. And so if we can talk about Indigenous women's resistance history in the context of love, that you can see that it's kind of never ending.
What was the process of having your spoken piece turned into a blog? Why did you pick blogging, and why was that effective?
I think blogging picked me. It was published on the Decolonization Education Society blog. And it was, you know, I had to change a spoken piece to right. add in like citations and links to other things, which was actually quite cool. When you do an academic article, you can't put a hyperlink in. You can't put, you can't cross-reference in that way, which you can do on an online blog. And I think that was very useful for that piece, too, because I could say, you know, I'm talking about a letter from the women of Turtle Island that was beautiful, and you can link to it, and people can go to it and read it for themselves. Mm-hmm. And so there's ways that you can make that article more dynamic than what it is that you're just saying. And I thought, oh, it's, you know, it was a good talk. I liked that article a lot. It's definitely shorter than an academic piece would be in a regular journal, which also makes it a different type of writing, and I think it's more dynamic. It's mm-hmm. not easier to write, it's more fun to write from my perspective. So it's in between a creative writing piece and an academic one. So that's a benefit. The just exposure, that article, for whatever reason, became really popular, and it just traveled, you know, on Twitter, it traveled on Facebook. So and even now, I see it because you get those notifications from Twitter. It's like, somebody just tweeted your article again. I'm like, man, that thing's now so old. Mm. So it just takes on a life of its own. It gets more exposure. No one's ever going to read something that I publish in an academic journal. Not no one, but maybe like 10 people. It's not going to have the same purchase. And for me, it makes it less exciting to produce. Stuff that you can do online and new media is something that can happen now. So it's much more activist. It's much more impactful in a contemporary this moment sense, but it still has a life of its own.
Could you talk to me about the It Ends Here series that was published by the Indigenous Nationhood Movement, and why do you think it was important?
It was a website that was set up for this very purpose, so that you could put out something very quickly, and it would reach Indigenous activists all over the world who have visited that site, or non-Indigenous people mm-hmm. as well. They did a series called It Ends Here. It Ends Here series is, like, I think, one of the most perfect examples of the kind of new media stories and activism that online content allows to happen. When Loretta Saunders was killed last year, there was a call out to respond immediately to how her death just brought to the forefront so much emotion, anger, sadness, and we wanted to talk about it, and we wanted to talk about it in an activist context, and we wanted to talk about it right now. We didn't want to, like, write an academic article on it and have it take 18 months to publish and mm-hmm. in a context that nobody's going to read, and it's not, who cares? And so a call was put out to artists, to creative writers, to scholars in the field, and that happened really, really quickly to put this tremendous resource together from all these various perspectives on what did this moment mean to us, and how can we not let other forms of media forget, not mm-hmm. understand what we're thinking about and how we think about violence against Indigenous women.
What are some other things to think about as we utilize social media as Indigenous feminists and activists?
You always say something like, when you send an email, when you're angry, to just save it in draft and then think about it later and see if you really want to send that. The thing about academic writing in a regular journal, it's peer-reviewed. You send it to someone. It's why it takes 2 years for something to get out. Mm-hmm. And you get lots of feedback about how you should say something, whether you should say something, if it makes sense, if it's problematic. And when you're producing pieces for online content that are in a more kind of journalistic deadline, like, I need this by tomorrow, or I need this to put this out now, you don't have the time to do reflection in the same way.
And so in thinking about putting ourselves out there as writers into cyberspace, how can we support each other and support ourselves in this process?
To not dwell only in the violence, but to think about resistance and resilience. But, you know, you have to be critical of those things, and so you have to talk about it, and you have to have support, a community to support you, whether that's your online community or your website that you're working with. Or other like-minded bloggers and people that you can support you in that. We know online that feminist bloggers right now are often constantly under attack by trolls and things who use violent threats to silence them. Mm-hmm. When you expose yourself in that way, you're going to get backlash. So you need support in many ways. And I think it's really brave for Indigenous bloggers and Indigenous women to put their voices out there, because it's hard work, it's hard to think through, and you're also exposing yourself in ways that might be even more difficult and scary.
What are some other things to think about as we utilize social media as Indigenous feminists and activists?
You know, we've had a few of the questions around different campaigns, like the Am I Next campaign or I'm Not Next, or those things, about how mainstream society understands it. And I come from a lit background, you know, this is something that we talk about all the time. It's, you know, it's up to the reader to be responsible, but you also, as a person who's creating work, you have to understand that your reader doesn't understand where you're coming from. They don't know, in terms of an Indigenous context, probably much about Indigenous life experience. All they are reading through is their own stereotypes. Mainstream society assumes Indigenous women are victims because they're Indigenous, that they're drudges, that they're not respected in their communities. And you put something out that talks about violence only as victimry, then you might be reaffirming somebody's idea that Indigenous women experience violence because they're Indigenous women. So you have to be careful about how you're putting stuff out there that doesn't reaffirm somebody's commitments to their own ignorance. Do they have the tools to understand where you're coming from? Are they going to read it in the ways that you want it to read it? And if you don't have the time to reflect on what you're putting out there, we can sometimes put things out there that, you know, I guess it'll do more harm than good. And so I think those were the representational critiques that a lot of people had about some of the online media campaigns around murdered and missing women, was it just reaffirming ourselves as victims, or was it actually challenging why violence happens? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like recognition. It was like, we don't need people to recognize this. We need them to understand it. Mm-hmm. And so Indigenous critiques of wanting only recognition can kind of work itself out here. Mm-hmm. It's not just about raising consciousness, because mm-hmm. people know this happens. They just don't want to think about why. And so if your campaign is only aimed at raising mm-hmm. the issue, it probably needs to go further.
And how do you think a successful campaign can do that? The answers, please.
I think you have to think about this issue in all its complexity and pick something about its complexity that you can talk to. Mm. So thinking about speaking to this as one issue is impossible for anyone, you know, and that's when people ask me to talk about violence against Indigenous women, I'm like, oh, where do I start? Mm-hmm. Do I start historically? Do I focus it from a resistance history? Do I focus it from here? I've chosen to think about it through love. I can't always do that, because mm-hmm. It becomes something that people can just feel good about and not actually do anything. You have to think about what small piece of this problem can I attend to in this thing that I'm doing, and then how can I do it creatively that's me, and then to speak to others about it, like ask people who are like-minded to really offer you some feedback. One of my favorite writers, if not my favorite writer, Linda Hogan, who's a Chickasaw writer, generally writes novels from the perspective of Indigenous youth who are working through the emotion of colonialism and trying to get back to, a space of self-love and love for their community. And her novel, Solar Storms, it ends that way. It ends with an affirmation. It ends with the main character saying that, you know, something beautiful lives inside me. Mm-hmm. And I finally realize that now. Mm-hmm. And so that's generally my approach to these kinds of things, is that you have to get people back to thinking about how to live a good life and be an ethical person. Mm-hmm. And that starts with the self.
Before we kind of wrap up, mm-hmm. is there anything that you're working on now or any work to expect from you in the future, apart from your hours spent as a professor?
Well, I'm still working on my book project. It's under contract with the University of Arizona, and it's very much all of these things that I've been talking about for years in courses, thinking about the intersections of Indigenous women's creative production and activism. It came out of a question that I had early on as an undergraduate scholar, thinking about the ways that people frame literature as either elitist practice or as not work, not activism, right? If you're an activist, you don't sit in your room and type up a story. And I just knew that's not how, it didn't operate that way in my own life and from my own communities, that stories were really important and held a lot of things, traditional knowledge, personal family histories. There's different ways that stories operate in your life and in your community, and that they're animate, that they're a part of how we practice. How do you help people in the field of literary or cultural studies understand that way of approaching story, and also get out a history of Indigenous women activism at the same time?
Okay.
So well, that's what I'm working on. Yeah. Just that thing.
Just that thing. Well, I'll read that book, and I know that you all will now read that book. Thank you so much for your time mm-hmm. and for being on the show. And as much as the questions were for my research on new media, they're also just like, it's helpful advice on how to further conduct myself and keep myself safe, and for all of you, how to conduct yourselves in just the most responsible and respectful ways. So it was very helpful.
Thanks, Celia.
Yes. Thank you. How do we learn to talk to each other in better ways? How do we hold each other up and recenter our communities around the love that currently and has always bound them together? Dory's exploration of Indigenous women's love for one another, themselves, the land, and their communities, how that love has been a target and how it continues to be a force is crucial. If you want to learn more, the articles that we spoke about were We Hold Our Hands Up on Indigenous Women's Love and Resistance, which can be found on the Decolonization blog, and then the It Ends Here series, which can be found on the Indigenous Nationhood Movement's blog. Thank you again to Dory Nason. Thank you for listening. Haichka Osiem.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule, being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
As a station, we believe in playing content with artistic and cultural merit, and sometimes that category includes material which can be construed as offensive. For those who have children nearby or are sensitive to provocative material, the following broadcast may have strong language, themes, or be otherwise objectionable. Please consider tuning out and revisiting CITR after this program.
You are tuned in now to CITR Radio, and you just heard one episode that is part of a three-episode series titled Mingling with Matriarchs, created by Celia Joseph. My name is Eleanor, and I am one of the hosts of Femme Concept, Fridays from 1 to 2 p.m. on CITR. CITR is located at the University of British Columbia, which is on the traditional, unceded territories of the Musqueam people. After I listened to Celia's podcasts, I had the privilege of sitting down with her to discuss the process of making Mingling with Matriarchs and to expand on some of the topics she discussed with the women she interviewed. Similar to the way Celia begins her interviews by discussing how the women began in their various fields, Celia and I began our interview by talking about how she came to UBC and later to CITR.
My name's Celia Joseph. I'm majoring in First Nations Studies at UBC. I'm going into my last year, and last year I did my practicum with CITR.
So what brought you to UBC?
Well, I think there were a few things, but it was like growing up on Vancouver Island, away from my community, the Squamish Nation. I kind of felt, I'd just kind of been feeling a pull back to Vancouver for a long time and wanting to live closer to that side of my family. Well, both sides of my family live in Vancouver, and I just wanted to know more about what it meant to be Squamish and where I came from. So I kind of felt just drawn and attracted to being back on this territory for so long. And it just worked out that that a way to come home was going to university. It gave me kind of a purpose. And then within school, the goal is also to be able to learn so that I could go back to my community too with something else to offer.
What drew you to the First Nations Studies program at UBC?
Well, I knew that I was interested in my Indigenous background, and I first thought that that interest could kind of manifest in anthropology, and so I gave that a shot and was like, "Ooh, this isn't right for me." Okay. And then I was deciding on where I wanted to go to school, because that was at Capilano University, and then I was just looking at courses at UBC online and saw this program. I was like, well, I'll give that a shot, and if I get into UBC, then I'll go. And then sure enough, I got in, and I kind of just took a shot without really knowing what Indigenous Studies was all about.
So your series, Mingling with Matriarchs, was created as part of your practicum project in the First Nations Studies program at UBC. Can you tell me a little bit more about the practicum program?
Yeah, so in the First Nations Studies program, in your last year, you do a practicum, and so it's this like professional placement, and you get partnered with an Indigenous organization in the city, and I picked CITR.
Cool. Did you know anything about CITR before coming here?
I knew a little bit, and I had been interested in potentially getting involved in radio before, and I kind of knew some people here through my partner, who's been pretty active and involved here in the past. I didn't really have much background.
And what kind of drew you to using audio and radio as the medium for the project?
After kind of 4 years of university and a lot of academic work, I really wanted to create something kind of tangible, to create a research project that was almost like physical, that I could share with my friends and family and have it a bit more accessible. So in thinking about different ways to achieve that, it seemed that radio was a pretty cool avenue to give that a shot.
Totally. Nice break from writing papers.
Yeah.
Before you came to CITR to work on this series, did you have any experience working with audio?
Music. I've worked with audio equipment around music, like kind of minimally, but never like sound editing for like radio or like editing like conversation and that kind of stuff.
And how was that experience?
Well, it was definitely like a huge learning curve. I ended up making 3 podcasts, each 25 minutes, and it just took months of editing.
Totally. I think people hear really great sounding audio and are like, wow, that's probably easy. And then you do it and you are very quickly aware that it is not.
No.
Rewarding though. So your series is called Mingling with Matriarchs, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about that title. I'm wondering what the word matriarchy means to you.
Yeah, well, I just wanted something that sounded like fun and engaging, and I liked the alliteration. Mm-hmm. And as a Native woman, I come from matrilineal people, so basically it was to kind of recognize the women that we come from, but it's more just like a play on words, because the women that I interviewed don't actually identify as matriarchs, but I think that the people who I was interviewing and the work that interests me, kind of this knowledge and this love and passion, kind of comes from these strong women in our lives that we would consider our matriarchs and our leaders.
Do you have a vision of what a ideal matriarchal society would look like?
Well, I think that as an Indigenous feminist, kind of like the ideas and some of the work behind that platform is just conceiving of a place where in our communities women can feel respected and revered and loved, and that's ideal. Like in our communities and outside of our communities, that Native women just have that space to be safe and, yeah, feel good and strong and loved.
So I know that Indigenous Feminisms is a course that's offered in the FNSP program, correct? Have you taken that course?
Yeah.
Cool. What was your experience like in that course? And do you feel like there are perspectives or ideas that Indigenous Feminisms can offer to other feminist theory?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, my experience with Indigenous Feminism in my program wasn't limited to that class. I think that Indigenous feminist scholars, their voices are in all of our classes. It's centered. But particularly that class, having such a focus on and getting to read so many authors and being taught that class by Anishinaabe Mexican scholar Dori Nason is just like totally like a groundbreaking experience for me. I just felt like so inspired and thrilled. And I think what Indigenous Feminisms does is it sets itself apart just by saying, like, look, here's all these things that we as women have to deal with and that we're committed to confronting, and these are the structures that that we all feel, but then here are the structures and the experiences that we have as Native women that we need to specifically attend to, such as the results of colonization, like, historically and contemporarily, like what we're experiencing as Native women now and how this is impacting our lives. And so I think there's lots of collaborations between Native feminists and other feminists talking about how they can be in dialogue with each other and how just how you can be accountable to each other. So other feminisms acknowledging like
where their what land their practice is being is taking place on, and who you're accountable to. So just thinking about what makes different feminisms unique and how women need to look out for themselves, and then like and then how you can be in conversation with each other in respectful ways.
Totally. In terms of campus, so how you've been here for 4 years now,
mm-hmm.
do you feel like there has been any changes or shifts in kind of the campus culture or attitude towards the Indigenous history of the land that UBC is on in your time here?
Well, I feel like FNSP is this, like, great, wonderful little bubble, you know, and it feels like that probably I have a conception of UBC as being a lot more conscious than it is because of who I kind of surround myself with.
Totally.
I'm often surprised when I step out about how little dialogue there is, you know, but I think that there are also people there that are trying really hard. There's lots of steps being made to kind of understand what it means to be on Musqueam land and how we're going to address that as a university. I also think there's a lot of work to do,
mm-hmm.
and it's just going to take more time and consultation and investment in these relationships and in education. I think it'd be great for the university to eventually have some kind of mandatory learning around Indigenous people issues and just have it more well known what it means to be guests on Musqueam territory.
Definitely. Some sort of first year course that everybody has
to
take. Yeah. In my mind, something like that isn't that hard to implement, but I am not an administrator at UBC, unfortunately, so not really sure. All right, so going back to the podcasts, I'm curious how you found the experience overall. Were there moments that surprised you? Were things harder than you thought they'd be?
I think I was surprised at how much I loved interviewing. I think it's kind of something that I've always done in some form my whole life. I've always been interested in asking questions. But to actually set it up a little bit more formally in kind of the context of research and new media, it was just really exciting, and I got to sit down with these women who I just adore and respect, and who I kind of felt like I knew pretty well, and then I just learned so much more, and that's an exciting feeling. So I just loved that. It was more I think probably the biggest surprise was how intensive editing is,
because mm-hmm.
these interviews were an hour and a half, and then they had to be edited down to basically 20 minutes of content. So how do you, when I was interviewing, any of them, how do you take someone's story and then just, how do you decide what to delete? And so I think that's also just kind of a realization of how much power there is as an editor or as in any kind of journalism role, how you decide to keep things and how you decide to do away with parts of someone's story.
In Mingling with Matriarchs, there are 3 episodes. One is with Lindsay LaChance, who is currently working on her PhD mm-hmm. in critical theory at UBC, or critical theater theory, and Maya Tailfeathers,
mm-hmm.
and she's a filmmaker and a graduate of the UBC FNSP program.
Mm-hmm.
And you also interviewed Dori Nason, who is a professor in the FNSP faculty who teaches Indigenous feminisms and Indigenous literature.
Yes.
So in all of these podcasts, there are discussions of new media and digital media and how they're being used by Indigenous people to share stories and experiences. What do you think is the role of this form of media based on your experience and your experience viewing work created by others?
Well, that's kind of what I was setting out to learn is how do different forms of new media inform all these different areas of focus, and it was just neat to hear how they influenced these women in very different ways but kind of for the same purposes and to the same end. And I think what was kind of made clear within all 3 of the interviews is kind of the relationships between new media and grassroots, and how lots of these different forms of disseminating knowledge are a lot more kind of accessible. So they're more accessible to the community, and then also for the community to be taking part in themselves. It's just kind of this way that it's like it's just a way to bridge gaps, it seems.
Mm-hmm. And definitely seems like an empowering thing. I feel like that's one of the things I see when anybody creates something with forms of media, be it radio or whatnot, when they have this thing and they're like, whoa, I made that.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it's people engage with it a little bit differently.
Yeah, totally.
So one of the things that is touched upon in your podcasts is the importance of Indigenous people having the opportunities to tell their own stories, as opposed to what has been seen historically with appropriation and colonization. I'm curious, what do you think is the importance and the impact of this?
Oh, I think it's crucial. I think that it's like it's the only way forward, I think, and it's the only way that I think will be tolerated for, or that should be tolerated within the academy and studying Indigenous people, is that it's Native people's voices who are centered. And I think that's also part of what podcasting can do, is instead of like writing about Dory, Maya, or Lindsay as though, like, as subjects, it's like just centering their voice, so that it's kind of taking away that degree of separation between the person who's learning from the material and these women themselves, and you're just literally inserting their voice right there, so you're learning from them directly. And I think there's still ways to do that within writing, but I think centering voices is just so important, and I think new media has a lot of ways to do that in really compelling ways, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Totally. In the process of setting up your interviews, because your project is a research project, you had to go through the process of having your questions approved by an ethics board. Can you tell me a little bit about this experience?
Yeah, so I guess because it's not your kind of average podcast. It was started as a research project. We had these like different steps to go through in practicum before we could even get going on setting up interviews. So we had to like fill out like a big ethics form and make a proposal, and then all of that had to be reviewed by our internal FNSP ethics board, and then an external ethics board, and then we have to make sure it's like minimal risk, so anything that we're talking about with these women is minimal risk, so it's not like it's not going to be triggering, it's not going to be touching on topics that we or I wouldn't have the resources to help them through. So we had to like have the questions outlined and what kind of we wanted to get out of these interviews, and then most of all it was also like making sure that we were going to be treating like the teachings and the learning that we received from these women like with the utmost respect. So they signed consent forms, and it outlined pretty much that like nothing will be published or disseminated until you've heard it and approved it, and if you don't like things, I'll change it. If you don't like any of it, then we won't run it. And then also it was like really clear with how CITR will use the material, so that there would be no surprises, kind of thing. So it's just this whole process of how to be as transparent as possible, basically.
Totally. That's really cool, because that's feels like a complete flip of what has happened in the past. And it really just highlights the value and importance of people's personal stories.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
I think often we like hearing stories from others and we appreciate it, but we sometimes forget to be appreciative of what it means for people to share
mm-hmm.
with us.
Yeah. It's not a right, you know, like it's a gift. And
totally. Totally. Yeah. Moving on to the interview that you did with Dory, I'm wondering what the first class was that you took with her and what that was like.
Oh, good question. I've taken a lot of classes with Dory. Now, what was my first class? She does 300 and 310, which are methodologies and theory, which are required courses for FNSP. I've taken her Indigenous Lit class and her Indigenous Feminisms class. I can't remember exactly which one was first because they all kind of happened at once. Mm-hmm. I can remember kind of the feeling of first taking her classes and just being like, whoa, thinking about centering women's voices like this and in a really exciting way. And also just how she goes about her classes. She's really invested in her students, and that comes through really clearly, and she's like pretty relaxed and really funny and just kind of captivates you, and just she gives great lectures and leads really good conversations. People joke that Dory creates these like little armies of Indigenous feminists because people just leave her classes being like just changed, I think, in really exciting ways.
That's really, really awesome. Well, from the small amount of reading that I've done so far and from your interview that I listened to, I get this sense that she was one of the people at the forefront of the development of Indigenous feminisms. In your experience, does this show through her teaching?
Well, I think Dory would want me to kind of talk about that a little further, because I don't think that she would identify as someone on the forefront necessarily. I think that in her classes she really brings in the work of women who have been doing this work for a long time, and then Indigenous women who have been doing activism work in the academy and outside, and without using the rhetoric of Indigenous feminisms too. So I think it's really been this long process. But I think what was interesting about the interview with her specifically is being just a part of this really exciting time where people were starting to gather more and more and starting to identify as Indigenous feminists and really starting to think about what that would be. But I think that she certainly, without a doubt, brought it to the academy in a new and exciting way that hasn't really been available in lots of other contexts. So in terms of like having an Indigenous feminist themselves teaching this course is a huge anomaly, I think. And so that was definitely a huge thing. Not to like underplay her work by any means. I just know that if she was listening, no, She'd be like, suffix this and contextualize this with the work of all these women that have kind of been working at this for a long time.
No, totally. No, that's great. And that's why I asked, because I feel like my learning into this
right.
is very preliminary.
Right,
and
right, for sure.
It's sometimes you read these things by people and you're not sure where to place them.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why we always feel the need to place them. One of the things that you and Dory talked about was the practice of bringing love into the study and practice of Indigenous feminism. And I'm wondering if this is something that you feel like you do, and what are the ways that you do it?
Yeah, I think that I do. I think that's probably like part of the joke too. She is like, makes this huge impact on people, and they think about love a little bit differently after having taken her courses. And I guess it just helped me understand the other side of the subordination of Native women, because so often we're talking about violence and we're talking about these really hard realities that Native women face, and we don't always talk specifically about where this comes from beyond certain conversations around colonialism. And so Dory's conversation of love really kind of situates Native women as these like powerhouses that, if anything, are a threat to the state. And so to situate the conversation around Native women that way, from a strength-based analysis, it's so empowering, and it's like infuriating and frustrating and scary. But if anything, it's like you're starting from the narrative of empowerment and honor and pride into where you come from and who you are, as opposed to starting from a narrative of violence and these other realities that we're well aware of, but there's always another side. And we're just doing it to feel good about this thing that's really hard, or like these realities are really hard. It's just giving you empowerment, as opposed to just being bogged down by violence and the threat of violence constantly. Because it's not like you're not still dealing with that, but you're also able to look at these other sides of this story.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that it gives a form of renewing energy to look at it in that way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you don't want to burn out from just these really hard realities and conversations.
Totally, totally. Towards the end of the interview that you do with Dory, she discusses the ways to take movements beyond just consciousness raising and bring them further. One of the suggestions that she offers is to pick one part of what are complex, multifaceted issues that a person feels like they can speak to and focus explicitly on that. Do you have thoughts about this strategy, and do you have any of your own?
I think that that was in the context of discussing social media and how to utilize this tool, which can be really great and really empowering and immediate and direct, but how to make it meaningful. And I think that part of what we talked about in terms of the discussion around new media and how to make something meaningful is what can you speak to? What are you invested in? How can you do something well, as opposed to these more abrupt kind of fleeting moments that might not have as deep or long an impact? In terms of what I might focus on in my own self, oh, there's lots. I think about my accountabilities to my communities. So what are my communities? So thinking about where I come from as a Squamish woman, what are these little things that I can be doing in my day-to-day or in my life, or what are my goals to be accountable to them within my own learning and my own responsibility to carry knowledge, and then how I represent that community in my day-to-day life. What are my responsibilities to them? And then thinking about my First Nations Studies community and these women that I have made really good relationships with and an amazing faculty, what are my responsibilities to them? And so thinking about my day-to-day on the university campus, what can I be taking with me into my classrooms? What can I be doing to contribute to this space to make it safer for me and others, or just more exciting? And I think that radio's been a really exciting way to kind of be accountable to lots of different communities at once, I think. So I really like to continue working within radio and within storytelling. I think that's a really compelling way that keeps me excited.
What do you think is the role of radio in Indigenous communities?
Good question. Well, when I was doing my practicum, I kind of asked myself that same question. Going into it, I'm like, okay, I'm going to make this podcast. What can I learn about this medium of radio going into the project? What's it meant for people? And so I did this extensive lit review, just researching the relationship between communities and radio. And it's just this long, vibrant, rich, very unique history that is it's been so important to people, whether it's your rural communities without access to voting or whatever, just current events, or to people who have very few language speakers and they have they have programming in their own language, or to communities that don't really speak much English and are able to have programming in their language. And so it's all these really unique, exciting ways. And I think more and more Indigenous podcasting is coming out, I think, because it's it's more grassroots, it's more accessible, you don't need much training to do it. And it's this kind of what I was saying earlier on when we spoke the other day, immediate kind of expression of knowledge, or this exchange that's pretty quick. And so I think it's just, it has a really interesting history, and I think it's continuing to evolve and continuing to be utilized for those reasons.
Are there any podcasts that you would like to recommend that center Indigenous voices or made by Indigenous folks, or any podcasts that you like in general?
There's this podcast collective that was started by Ryan McMahon called Indian and Cowboy. So if you were to Google it, I would suggest doing Indian and Cowboy podcasts, because I just typed in Indian and Cowboy the first time and it comes up with really weird things that aren't what you're going to be looking for.
Totally.
But it's an Indigenous run like podcast collective, and all of the shows are by Indigenous podcasters. So it's really cool, and it's all just there for download. It's free. One of my favorites is Métis in Space, which is these two Métis women. They will watch some kind of episode of science fiction that has some kind of like Native content, and then just like talk about it afterwards. Mm-hmm. And they're just really funny, and they're also like really critical, but in a pretty gentle, well, not gentle, like, I don't know. It is accessible. It's accessible, but it's also still like a very high level, but it's just really funny. Oh God, they're so funny. So I would definitely recommend that, even if you don't like sci-fi.
Cool.
It's so good.
Cool. Well, those are all of the questions that I have, but I want to thank you so much for giving me your time and sharing these podcasts with me. I've learned so much, and more than that, I feel so much more eager to fill the never-ending gaps within my own knowledge about the issues that you're talking about. So, yeah, thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much for having me and expressing an interest.
Yeah. I'm excited for the world to hear these. If you'd like to hear the other podcasts in Celia's series, Mingling with Matriarchs, you can find them online on the CITR Mixcloud at www.mixcloud.com/CITR_radio. And if you'd like to learn more about the First Nations and Indigenous Studies program at the University of British Columbia, you can visit their website at fnis.arts.ubc.ca.